or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Dale Carnegie's classic book is How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's still at the cornerstone of many luminaries' success. For example, the only diploma that hangs in Warren Buffett's office is his certificate from Dale Carnegie Training. Lee Iacocca, the famous CEO of Chrysler, credits Carnegie for giving him the courage to speak in public. Dilbert creator Scott Adams called Carnegie's teachings, quote, life-changing. Frankly, I've always had mixed feelings about the book. On the one hand, I do recognize that its message of listen more, talk less, be positive works. And actually, it's motivated me to be a better listener and look where I can to find the positive and to think twice before criticizing, then doing it tactfully. But the book's focus is kind of on the sizzle rather than the steak. You know, smile and you're going to convince people, even when you're trying to convince somebody of something that isn't that great. Well, despite those mixed feelings, I thought it was, given its classic nature and that has just been updated, is now called How to Win Friends and Influence People in a Digital Age, I decided to delegate the reading of that book to my wife, the Napa County Superintendent of Schools, member of the State Superintendent's Cabinet on his technology committee even, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hi, I can't believe, you know, I was calling you. I wanted to give you one more minute before I called you, and you called in first. So thanks for being eager.
You bet.
Okay.
It's a fun book to talk about.
Well, I'm glad. Well, obviously, in a digital age, Facebook, email, LinkedIn, they're all key to creating connections, which, of course, is core to any how-to book. Does the book How to Win Friends and Influence People in a Digital Age offer advice about how to make digital connections into making them into a strong human connections?
It does. I think, although the book has been criticized for really being mostly the same book and just tied to the digital world to sell the same book again, he reminds us, well, not he, obviously, Dale Carnegie's long gone, but the book reminds us that in a digital age where we are increasingly communicating not face-to-face, that it is essential that we make personal connections and that we use some of the principles in a digital way. It also reminds us that where you can, if you can make that personal connection face-to-face, having virtual friends is very nice. You could have 8,000 virtual friends, but if you don't actually meet a person, it's not the same thing.
Yeah, I know that. But I'm, you know, and I'm always, you know, I am a guy who is kind of a hermit by nature, and so whatever emailing or Facebooking I do, I do try to make it as personal as I can because I recognize the importance of that. And so I have, like, use little techniques like, if I'm writing an email, I say, you know, it was really good to hear from you, Joe. I use his name. I always put his name, not always, but frequently, put his or her name at the end of a sentence. Are there any strategies that the book discusses for how, in this digital age where so much communication is digital, how to build a deeper human connection than just presenting the facts as a precursor, potentially, to an in-person relationship? Or sometimes relationships are across the world. They have to be digital.
Yes. He says that this gives you an opportunity to affirm somebody to thousands of people. So if you are thinking of the positive and you're making a comment on Facebook, it's a wonderful time to give the other person some positive strokes because that has a reverberating effect around the world these days.
Absolutely. Boy, that is so true. Simply liking someone on Facebook, you know, is great. And when somebody retweets something that I have written, that builds my bond. I'm going to tell a true story. Marcy Albaher was a columnist at the New York Times, and she had quoted me a couple of times in her column, and so we kind of had this very limited, distant relationship. But I saw her name on the Twitter stream, and I decided to follow her and saw some stuff that she had written. And she had written, she says, One of her tweets was, Education in America with Fareed Zakaria on CNN. It's all about reinventing education. So I email her back and I say, it's a great tip. I'm wondering if you've also, if it's going to be, if the ideas are better than what I wrote in my Reinventing Education. And then retweeted hers. She emailed me right back. She said, great. And that put her in my consciousness. And then what I did is, I write for the Washington Post now. I referred her to my boss at the Washington Post, who was looking for somebody who works in the field of charitable giving, which is where she is now. So bottom line, you can, by saying positive things about somebody else, can create quite deep bonds.
Absolutely. And the book says that, remember, we are all united by one single desire, to be valued by other
people.
It's
so true.
And so when you do that digitally, it makes people feel close to you.
Yeah. You know, there was a study done by UC Berkeley researchers that found that you cannot flatter too much. You cannot, especially your boss. We all crave feeling good about and validated about ourselves. And the flip side of that is we are terrified of being embarrassed. We will go to enormous lengths to avoid being embarrassed. So, yes. Anything else specifically related to regarding digital communication in the book?
The other thing he talks about is the reverse of that. That where before you could make a complaint, you could do it carelessly. You go to a restaurant and you say to your friend, boy, that was really lousy service that I got. But what people forget is when they do it digitally, it can have profound implications. And he gives a couple of examples. So a waitress at a pizza restaurant had a complaint about some customers who gave her a very small tip after she waited on their table for 3 hours. And in those 3 hours, one of those hours was past her shift. And then she gets this crappy little tip. So she writes on her Facebook page, thanks for eating at Bricks, and then went on to call them cheap and other things. She got fired. You have to realize that the implications of putting things in writing like that can cost you.
Well, you know, this may be a little less obvious point. I had on Yelp, I had some really great reviews, but I had a terrible review that I truly felt was undeserved, but it was terrible. You know, and that happened maybe a year ago. And you know what that did for me? I am now so aware of what you just said, that if somebody writes something bad about you, it can be read by thousands of people. So while I've always been really careful to try to be, you know, absolutely as good as I can be every session, it's that one bad Yelp review has stayed in my brain. And so every time I'm with a client, every minute I'm saying, am I really being my best? Am I really, you know, there is that fear that, God forbid, somebody should write a bad Yelp review that maybe makes me a better career counselor.
That's an interesting point. I'm not sure that most of us think about that, but it is terribly important.
In this day and age, the first page of your Google results is the modern day resume. People don't look for your resume. They don't even look for your references anymore. They Google you, and they see what's on the first page, and perhaps they will then look in your LinkedIn references. But references are still, you know, they're BS. You can get people to write references about you even if you're not great. But they're relatively unscreened is the first page, or all of your Google results. So you need to make sure that your reputation and is really great. And if you've got, you know, sometimes I had a client who was a pool installer, and he had, you know, he was great, but he had one woman who was really unhappy with the pool he installed, and she wrote the most scathing review of him, and called him all kinds of names, dishonest, this and that, and it has tortured him, if only psychologically, through his whole life. So one of the ways you can beat that is you keep putting up good content of your own so that it ranks higher in the Google results. So, you know, so the good stuff is on the first page, and her terrible review got buried eventually down onto page 2 or 3. So the power of digital communication is critical.
Huge. I'm sitting here feeling totally paranoid, like I better look myself up on Google immediately.
We all should. Everybody needs to periodically Google yourself. You'll learn a lot. You may, you know, hopefully you'll be very reassured and it'll be great. But, you know, one of the rules, by the way, is if you do get a piece of negative feedback, at least the conventional wisdom, and I think I agree with it, is respond. Pick up the phone and call that person. See if you can make it right. And maybe they'll take it down. Or, at minimum, we'll diffuse them from future activities. Or if you have an opportunity, for example, as in Yelp, this woman had come, the woman who didn't like me complained that she didn't get enough value in the one session she was with me. And I said, I'm really sorry you feel that way. Your problems were rather complex and weren't able to be solved in one session. I probably should have even offered to give her a free session, although that would have felt dishonest because I felt I was so unfairly judged. But responding to the negatives, or at least contemplating whether you should respond to the negatives that you may get in your first page of Google responses is pretty important.
And I think it's also important for all of us to take a deep breath before we just vent, because the implications are so much greater for the person that you're venting about than what it would be if you're just sounding off in the privacy of your small circle of friends.
Absolutely. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. Barbara Nemco has read the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People in a Digital Age, just published. And we're talking about the importance of digital relationship building, if you will, which ends up, as we're ever busier, ever more distant, our coworkers may be in another country, let alone in the next cubicle. The criticality of how to go about creating good relationships on the internet. But a lot, of course, the principles of creating good relationships and winning friends and influencing people digitally are the same principles that would be applying in in-person environments. So, for example, and this is like totally shallow, the book spends a chapter discussing smiles. What does that have to do with the digital age? And tell me about the whole smile thing.
Oh, I love the chapter on smiles. Smiles are so important and so enormous that we forget sometimes that the way people perceive you can be changed by the way you smile, how sincere it is, how broad it is. And they talk in the book about the all-time most viewed videos on YouTube. And there is one, and I bet you've seen it, I know I've seen it, from the United Kingdom. I mean, the book's a couple of years old, but still, there's the story of or the video of Harry, who's a three-year-old boy with his one-year-old brother, Charlie. And Charlie grabs one of Harry's fingers and shoves it in his mouth. And a minute later, he bites down on it, and Harry yelps and takes his finger out. But the whole time, Charlie is smiling. And that smile is enough to overcome the fact that he just bit his little brother. And Harry starts to smile, too, and giggle, just because his brother, who bit him, was smiling. The other most viewed video is from Sweden. We've all seen that one, and there are lots of copycats of it. A little baby boy smiles and giggles in response to his parents trying to make him laugh, making silly sounds. And there's 2 minutes of nothing more than this little baby smiling. One of the most viewed YouTube videos of all times.
Smiles are irresistible. You know, I hike around the Lafayette Reservoir every day with Einstein, and there are some people whose heads are, their brows are furrowed, their heads are down, and you, as you pass somebody with a smile, you can't help but like them. It's a visceral thing. It is very important. And yet, I got to think, I'm always interested in the contrarian point of view. So, you know, Arthur Miller kind of parodied the capitalist American way as, hey, all you need to do to succeed is a smile and a shoe shine. Well, is it dangerous to be encouraging us to focus so much on the gift wrapping, that is the smile, that the product inside could be crap and we therefore obfuscate that?
Well, that's so funny, because that just reminded me of one Christmas when we had a fabulous gift for Amy, who was maybe 7 at the time. It was a beautiful, long, velvet brown dress. It was something that I knew she would love. And not planning appropriately, I didn't have a box to wrap it in or wrapping paper. And so I draped it attractively over somewhere near the Christmas tree. She hated it because it didn't come gift wrapped.
It's amazing.
She couldn't see the dress for the fact that it was just laying there. So, yes, although it's easy to say that it's all about the smile. It isn't. You think about a delicious meal, but if it comes on a plate that is unattractive and it's just, you know, just kind of smeared all over the plate, it takes away your appetite.
You know, I'm aware that from a pragmatic point of view, if we want to live in this world, this is the way the world is, and we have to take a great deal of effort in our appearance. I mean, look at how big the cosmetic industry and the fashion industry in this country. Even in a recession, people spend a fortune, you know, $15 on a makeup, on a lipstick, and $40 on yet another pair of shoes. And yet, should we not, if we're not just talking about pragmatically trying to survive in the system as it is, but as we as parents or as grandparents or consumers, should we be not teaching our kids to emphasize the steak, not the sizzle, the product, not the gift wrapping, when we, rather than spend, you go to more, some fancy restaurant like Miramoto in Napa, and you're going to spend $50 on some small plates of something because it's perfectly presented in vertical stuff with green crap around it. I would much rather frequent Taqueria Rosita with its plain tables, its plain food, delicious at one-tenth the price. Should we not be trying to not just accept the shallow superficiality and focus on the packaging, but at least be aware of it and try to make some efforts in our personal lives to focus on the steak, not the sizzle?
I don't think that it's fair to make it a dichotomy. I think what he's saying, and I'll go back to your restaurant example, we're not talking about giving bad food beautifully presented. What we're talking about is making a connection with people. People want to be around happy people. So taking the smile analogy to mean a whole lot of other things may not necessarily be what they're trying to say. What they're saying is we feel happier when we're around happy people.
Yep.
When you give someone a big smile, they feel happier,
yep,
and therefore they would rather be around you. So if I go into, whether it's Morimoto or Taqueria Rosita, if the waitress comes over and she has a big, warm, welcoming smile and she makes me feel like she's glad to see me as a customer, then I'm glad to be there. And if she comes over and she's in a bad mood for whatever reasons of her own and she scowls at me or she's rude to me, it doesn't matter how good the food is, I don't want to go back.
You know, I remember there's a place in San Francisco, a noodle house, I think it's called Sam Woe's Noodle House or whatever, which is famous and has built its business on how rude the clerks are to the people taking the order. So there are counterexamples. But in general, you're right. But what advice would you give? There are some people who are by nature bubbly. You know, our granddaughter, Leah, is bubbly and bright and smiles all the time. But there are others who are just serious by nature. And if they try to smile, it comes off as phony because they're trying to. A natural smile looks very different than a forced smile. We've all seen salesmen who try to put on this smile and it's phony. What advice does the book have, or do you have, for somebody who is serious by nature?
I would say, number one, you can do nothing more important for yourself than practice smiling. Somebody taught me years ago how to smile for a photo. I had no idea that when you smile for a photo, if you put your tongue up by your alveolar ridge, you get a really natural-looking, good smile. People always say to me, oh, my God, you're so photogenic. No, it was because somebody taught me how to smile. So, number one, I would practice that. The other
in front of a mirror, would you practice your smile in front of a mirror?
What? In front of a mirror, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
See how you look.
Yeah.
The other thing they talk about in the book is how do you smile through your written words? Because, again, most of the time you're not going to be in face-to-face communication with this person. So we have all these cute little things that we attach to emails. We have little smiles by doing a colon and a half parentheses, or there are cute little things that you can get right on the computer, different kinds of smiles that you can add to an email. And how you write, you have to think about the tone. How is this email going to be perceived? Is there a smile in there? You know, somebody told me, and I think you have it by your phone. I've always had it by mine. If you pick up your phone and smile into the phone, that is heard on the other end. Not the smile, but the warmth, the welcome can be felt in your words.
Yep. It's not by my phone, but you're right. I know it's true. Okay. You know what? I think that probably the listeners might want to take a shot at you or me, or say something nice. Right? Yes. Yes. This is a nonviolent show. So, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment related to how to win friends and influence people, perhaps in a digital age, but perhaps just the old-fashioned way. Maybe it's a problem you're facing. You have got a difficult situation. You don't know how to go about communicating it well. We invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The book talks about how to connect to core motives. What does that refer to?
That you have to think about what it is that everybody wants. What is it that's going to really resonate with them? So who is this person? What is going to, you know, ring his chimes? And if you can, that's what Steve Jobs did. Steve Jobs came up with things that everybody really wanted, but we didn't know we wanted it. And that's what made him stand out so much. That's what was responsible for the success of Apple computers. Who knew we needed those things?
Those are not core motives. I'm curious. When I think about that, I think of that everybody has one or more of the following that has a real emotional tug for them. And it could be love. They're single. They want to get in a relationship, or they want to improve their relationship. Their health, money, their career, their looks, their family, some hobby they're interested in. So it seems to me what we're talking about here is, how do you, first of all, identify those core motives? And that's usually just through good listening and asking questions. And then try to appeal to that. Is it money? Is it status? Is it health? Is it whatever? Does that make sense?
Yes. And of course, there are certain things that we all want. We all want to be successful. We all want to be well-liked. We all want to have good food. I mean, there are certain universal things that everybody thinks is important. And so let me give you a wonderful example that he used in this book that I thought was too... Who wrote this book?
It's a couple of people that is from the Dale Carnegie Institute.
They wrote, because clearly Dale Carnegie is, as I said earlier, long gone.
Yeah, he's doing his communication in the ethereal world.
Perhaps.
Yes, right. Okay.
So the book talks about the philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Right.
And he and his son were trying to get a calf into the barn.
Okay.
And they were having an awfully hard time because they pushed, the calf pulled, they pulled, the calf pushed. They were not being successful. Now, there was a maid watching this, and she was not brilliant, and she didn't write great essays or books like Ralph Waldo Emerson did, but she had an insight. She walked over to the calf, and she put her finger in its mouth. And while the calf was sucking on her finger, she led it into the barn. Well, what did she know that the brilliant Ralph Waldo Emerson didn't know? She knew that what is a calf's core desire? Food. So by putting her finger into his mouth, it reminded the calf that in the barn, it was very likely that there would be food or milk or something delicious. And so he wanted to go where she wanted to take him. What Ralph Waldo Emerson wanted to do was get the calf into the barn. Calf didn't care. That was not his core motive.
You know, one wonders why she put her finger in the calf's mouth rather than, some grass or something, or some, cow food, whatever cow food is.
Well, because with her finger, she could lead him in.
Okay. You know,
he's sucking on there.
There was a certain irony.
Going back to Apple, when Steve Jobs figured out that the PC should be like the digital hub of all your technology, your camcorders, your cameras, your MP3 players, your palms, your cell phones. And that was his vision. And yes, it made sense to all of us that we didn't want everything to be separate. There were too many things to keep track of. We wanted everything to run off of one thing.
Yep, that iPhone RS is really going to do wonders. You know, I must admit I'm amused. I have read Emerson, and Emerson's most famous essay is on self-reliance. And and he talks about that all should come from within. He's the opposite of it takes a village guy. And here it took his assistant to move the car. He certainly could not do it by himself, but I digress. Anyway, I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a question or a comment regarding how to win friends and influence people, especially if you've got a problem you're facing that is in the communication arena, digital or otherwise, I invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415 415- 844-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty and Barbara. What's on your mind?
Hi, Barbara and Marty. Well, I'm blessed to be able to and to be happy and to smile naturally and to attract plenty of customers. But I know a lot of people resent having to smile all the time.
That's what I just said, right?
Especially in America, it's you have to pump it up all the time. But, however, something you forgot to mention is that people can get away with it in businesses where if your customers see you as absolutely indispensable. I have a friend who, she was a hairstylist, and every time I went in there, she was downright rude to her customers. She'd tell them, shut up, sit down, and then she would, like, take her friends in and squeeze them in between paying customers. Mm-hmm. She would do all the worst things, but they loved her styling so much that she was flooded always with customers. I mean, they would just eat it up. Even her, they just loved everything. So unless you're indispensable, you really have to sugarcoat yourself and just do it. I don't mind if I'm in a restaurant. I don't mind if a waitress doesn't smile because there's a million reasons that, she can. And I like to kind of give her a little break. If the food is good and the service is good, I let her have a little break from smiling. But I know that most customers don't. And I know people have to be, you have to expect the consequences.
That is precisely what we just were saying. I said I was decrying the fact that we have to place in America so much emphasis on the gift wrapping, on the sugar coating. And I also mentioned that indeed competence can sometimes trump, trump the lack of a smile. So anyway, I thank you for supporting that notion. Thanks for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to work with.
I think the point that the caller made, though, is right. You have to be so exemplary to be able to get away
right.
with that.
Exactly.
That's the standard most of us are not going to hit all the time.
I know. And that's why I have mixed feelings about How to Win Friends and Influence People. It reinforces the notion that a smile and a shoe shine, literally and metaphorically, is what's going to get you by. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty and Barbara. What's on your mind? Hello, are you there?
Hello.
Hi. Hi. It's your turn on the air.
Fantastic.
Good.
First, I want to express my gratitude for both of you and the wonderful service that you provide.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's very sweet of you. I'm smiling now. Very broadly.
That's great. What was that, Barbara?
I said, and so are you. I could see the smile in your voice.
Oh, that's great. I am. It's true. Yeah, I could say a lot about the book. I remember reading it when I was 20, and I'm 40 now. And I usually work on Sundays. It's very rare for me to be able to call in live, and I have been wanting to for probably a year. And I would love to be able to take the opportunity, if possible, to ask about my career process.
Certainly.
Okay? Yeah? Okay.
Go for it.
Thank you. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. I started working very young. I started a jewelry business when I was 12. Mm-hmm. I've done many different things, and with the economy shifts and a lot of personal losses, I lost my home and business to a fire. I've had to reevaluate very intensely over the last 5 years, and I really reached a point where I really didn't want to be an entrepreneur anymore. Mm-hmm. I was a coach for 12 years, but I always had other businesses that supplemented my income. I love to write. I love people, and I've gone to school at City College. For the last year, I took a career counseling class, really, kind of going, okay, with my strengths and my passions, is there a career that I could do where I worked for somebody else that I felt passionate about? And I haven't found that. I'm still continuing to go to school, and, I'm like, well, would an AA really do me any good in the current economy, if I went to school for the next few years and got my A and didn't move on to get a bachelor's.
Let me ask you a few questions. Probably not.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about in the coaching that you did, where, if there you had a natural gift, where was the gift? And if you say nothing, we can move on.
I do a lot of work with people on relationships.
Okay. And you said you ran a jewelry business. If you look at all, you said you've been entrepreneurial all your life since when you were 12. What would you say, was there some gift you had either or passion either within the products you sold or the nature and what you did? Where are there any nuggets, any clues within that, that might help us figure out what you might be able to be doing as an employed person?
I have an extraordinary gift for design, aesthetics. I've designed anything and everything from bathtubs to, furniture, clothing, jewelry. I'd say in terms of my current strengths and passions, that is still there. I've done a lot of renovating.
I'm going to propose this very specific idea.
One of my greatest passions and strengths.
Got it. What I want to do is I'm going to propose a very specific idea, and then we're going to. What's your first name?
Sahai.
And Sahai, we're going to ask you to score it on the Sahai meter. The Sahai meter goes from 0 to 10, with 0 means the idea makes you puke and 10 means it gives you ecstasy, okay?
Okay.
You are going to work for a small either furniture or design firm, interior design firm or something like that, and you are going to say, I can do lots for you. I can sell because I'm a people person. I can write copy for your website. I can start a blog if you want. I can do customer service. And when people are complaining or they have questions, I can email because I like to write. I have the combination of the design and aesthetic skills, the relationship skills, and the writing skills, and therefore you should hire me. What does that score on the Sahai meter?
Between 5 and 6.
Okay, what keeps it from being a 10?
I think probably I would prefer to do more things that are more intimate with people or more catalytic. I mean, the thought of selling at this point, I'm not thrilled about.
Okay. So in the relationship here, because you don't even have an AA degree and, to be a licensed, counselor or whatever requires, master's or a doctorate. So that's not going to happen. So we're, but you want to work.
Well, I've evaluated whether to do that. I did do 12 years of private training, coaching, clinical hypnotherapy.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a lot. 12 years. You don't want to throw that away so fast. And especially since you love relationships, you've done 12 years of that. Maybe what you need to do is join a group practice. There are very often group practices, especially women love to bond and connect. They have a massage therapist with a acupuncturist, with a psychotherapist, with a nutritionist, with a, et cetera. Maybe you want to join a group practice, and so you're not off on your own being your own entrepreneur, but you have the collective support and can do joint marketing with some other practitioners where you don't need any more credentials. What does that score on the meter?
That's hard because in my experience with the economy, it's just been challenging for people in those.
Of course, everything is challenging. There are no more in this economy. There are no more low-hanging fruit. So one of the antidotes to that is to become a very narrow specialist. So, for example, you say you're 40 and you like relationships. So if you're if you said I'm going to specialize only in newly broken up relationships in midlife women, for example, that would give you a huge edge over the 10 zillion other coaches out there. What if we said that, yes, the competition's enormous in everything. At 40 years old, with no degrees and soft skills like relationship and writing and aesthetics, and you don't want to sell, it is going to be tough anywhere in this economy. Therefore, the key is you say, all right, I need to, and it's a dirty word and among many people, I need to compete. I need to come up with a great niche. I need to be better at it. I'm using my strengths. What about that concept of picking a narrow niche, marketing very specifically to that niche? So, for example, you might, if you're going to focus on coaching these women who are just broken up, or it could be men too, just broken up with relationships, so you're going to do free workshops at single seminars, write articles since you like to write for Match.com or whatever, and that will be the basis on which you get clients. Is it still score crappy on the meter, on the Sahai meter?
I was working on doing exactly that when I got to my point of total burnout and just said, I need a paycheck. I was, narrowing it, being the love doctor, which was really my niche for many years, and kind of going, what's something that people are in so much pain that they're willing to pay for no matter
what? I want to take one more crack at it before I let you go, just because in the interest of time.
Yeah.
What you need is a stable job to provide some structure in your life without...
I have that.
So you have that. That's,
I have that right now.
Well, that's what I was picturing. I was picturing a day job that was some, you know, working in a kind of a service, people-oriented thing, whether it be in a bookstore or whatever, an art store, you know, since you're design-oriented, or the aforementioned furniture store or even Home Depot in their design department, and then being smarter about how you market the coaching practice. That's the best I'm coming up with. What? Give me one more bit of feedback on that. What feels good and yucky about that?
I guess I just spent so much money and so much time trying to figure out how to be effective with my marketing and reach the people who would pay for my services. And it felt very daunting, like, you know, endless, the internet and the...
Okay, one other thought then.
2 years of working on my skills, writing a copy for the internet.
Again, in the interest of time, then the last thing, when people can't do the marketing well, they just don't have the gift of it, I would outsource that. I would offer to do some of the writing, because you say you love to write, but I would get somebody who, you know, you say you're daunted by the internet, etc. There is a there is a social media marketing expert under every rock in the Bay Area. Now, again, there's plenty of people in every field. You can, for very little money, they're all unemployed. Everybody's unemployed today, or very underemployed, or at least willing to work for $12 or $15 an hour. You could probably get a reasonably good marketer, especially in the social media space or in general, for $15 an hour or on commission only. They get a percentage of what they bring in, since that's the daunting part. It seems to me, at least based on the 5 minutes we've spent together, that the sweet spot for you is going to be focus, you know, having a stable day job so you've got some structure, and doing some of the writing for the marketing, focusing on what your little niche is, and outsourcing the parts of the marketing that are daunting for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense.
All right.
And I guess I would love to know one writing careers that, you know, with the current reality that we're in, writing careers, things that I could do with my writing skills.
Okay, writing careers. Here is a list of writing careers that work, that pay. Most people with your sensibilities, as I'm hearing, you like design, you like relationships, you like jewelry and coaching, you're going to puke, but because there are a million writers out there also, the ones that pay are the ones that are doing stuff that most people with those sensibilities don't like. They are writing copy for an e-commerce website. They are writing annual reports for a business. They are technical writers. Sometimes they will ghostwrite for an executive who needs letters written or a speech. There is customer service writing. There are millions of people. Unfortunately, many of them are overseas, but there still are some customer service email sent customer service jobs in the United States. There is ghostwriting books for what one of my favorite niches is, has been celebrities. The really famous ones, you know, Lindsay Lohan, you're not going to get to write her her biography. But somebody who was last year's hot star, who's now faded, is desperate that he or she is going to fall into anonymity and is very open to having somebody write their biography. So finding last year's star, writing their biography for them, ghostwriting it, just like Hillary Clinton had somebody write all of her books for her. That's an angle. And writing, and again, most people don't make money at this, but there are writers who write personal histories. Old people who are afraid of dying or facing their mortality, they want to leave a legacy, and so they hire people called personal historians to write books about themselves and their family. Do any of those? Oh, and there, of course, there are writing coaches who coach high school and college students to finish their theses, their term papers, etc. Does any of that buffet of writing centric ideas appeal to you more than what we were talking about before?
Maybe not more, but equally. I mean, some things in conjunction with, I could see.
Okay. Well, I've given you my best for at least that we could do within the confines of the radio show. So I want to thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
I appreciate it so much. But, you know, can I just ask one last thing about the writing?
Sure.
Just, would the AA help me for
no.
any of those?
No. An AA, unfortunately, we live in what I call, remember in the, I don't know if you remember, in the 50s or 60s, it was a term called nuclear proliferation, that everybody was getting bigger bombs. Well, now we are in an era of degree proliferation, where it seems like, frankly, everybody has a bachelor's and a master's, and there are You know, there was a study recently that found that in 2011, over half of bachelor's degree holders were doing jobs that don't require any more than a high school diploma. That is clerks and cashiers and waiters. So, frankly, at age 40, getting an associate degree, except for certain government jobs where they're going to require a certain degree, you know, certain companies will require some degree. But it's truly a big bet, because normally if you don't have many units, they say it takes 2 years to get an associate degree. That is what's called the expected time, but colleges are deceptive. They use the term accepted time when, in fact, the actual average time that it takes people to get an associate's degree, especially at age 40, is more like 4 years. And that's a big chunk of your life for a very small increase in your probability of getting hired to make a middle-class living. One of the cliches is most people are getting degrees now and they're not even making enough money with the degree to pay back the student loans, let alone earn a student a living, especially given that you've not mentioned technology. I just looked at Indeed.com is a website that aggregates 5 million job listings, and they do a survey every month of the fastest growing keywords found in job postings. And the top three are mobile operating systems, social media, and information technology. Those do not sound like they're part of your background. So if you're going to go and you get an associate's degree, you know, kind of a liberal artsy with a liberal arts orientation, you know, rather than some very techie specialization, the odds are even smaller that you're going to, that is going to, at least in terms of money, you know, pay off. You may grow, you will grow as a thinker, as a person, as a connoisseur of life. But you've been focusing your questions to me on career issues. It is certainly very far from a slam dunk that going for the AA is going to be of value.
Well, I really appreciate that.
I did my best. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara.
Thank you.
And Barbara, thank you for your patience. Let's go back, though, to the book. Let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. Barbara has read a book called the newly updated version. There's an old book called How to Win Friends and Influence People, but just this, like, last month, a book was published that is the update of that called How to Win Friends and Influence People in a Digital Age. We started earlier in the show talking about the very digital aspects, but we agreed that much of what is in that book is applicable to all of us, whether we're communicating digitally or not. One of the chapters in the book that you said you wanted to talk about, Barbara, and let our listeners know who this joining us, Barbara Nemko, my wife, Napa County Superintendent of Schools, is the protagonist here. Tell us about the chapter, Give Others a Fine Reputation to Live Up To. What's that about?
That's very sweet. And because the first example that they give is in education, of course, I loved it. Here was a teacher who was tired. He taught in a music conservatory and was anxious about his kids and having to grade them all the time. And because they were nervous about not getting a good grade, they were all trying to take a safe approach to music. And he knew as a teacher that in order to make it to the top tier in the art world, you have to be kind of different. You have to stand out. And they were all trying to play it safe so they'd get good grades. So he decided that what he would do is give every student in the class an A on the first day of school.
Right.
I think you've heard this before.
No, because when I remember taking an English class as an immature 18-year-old, the professor came in and did exactly that, said everybody's getting an A, and you know what? I was lazy. I was so embarrassed. I didn't take that as an opportunity to take risks. I was lazy. I ended up doing little work. It backfired on immature Marty Nemko. Continue.
Well, it may be that he didn't do it right. You don't just say everybody gets an A. What he said to them was, everybody's going to get an A. However, here's the requirement that you have to fulfill to earn the A.
Hmm.
During the next 2 weeks, you have to write me a letter that's dated next May.
Hmm.
And in the letter, you have to tell in as much detail as you can the story of what will have happened to you by next May.
Wow.
That is in line with your getting this A.
Wow.
And so he said to the students, I want you to think of yourselves in the future. I want you to look back at everything that you're going to have done over this year.
Mm.
And you're going to give me your insights. You're going to tell me whether the milestones, what competitions did you win? And I'm really interested in what kind of a person you will have become by next May. What will your attitudes, feelings, and worldview be?
when you've done all these things that you wanted to do to be the person who gets the A.
Very interesting. Now, I understand that sounds like a great technique. How does that apply to the chapter, Give Others a Fine Reputation to Live Up To?
Oh, I don't know that it necessarily, well, okay. In a sense it does, because he was telling them that you're A students, you are A quality students, now I want you to live up to that. And that's what the chapter, Give Others a Fine Reputation to Live Up To, is about. It's the same kind of thing that you want to tell them. Here's another story that...
Before you do that, I just want to respond to that. I mean, that's the kind of BS that makes me worried about this book. I mean, not everybody is an A student. It's like, you know, you ever see these books out now that, you know, we're all geniuses, we just need to find it? That feels disingenuous to me. What's your reaction to that?
Well, he wasn't guaranteeing them an A. He was telling them how they were going to have to earn the A. The students who did not write that letter and live up to the things that they said weren't going to get an A. He was starting with the presumption that they could make themselves good enough through very hard work and practice and competitions and doing all the things that he was hoping, then they would have earned the A. But he wasn't guaranteeing everybody they were getting an A. Remember, there was that requirement.
Okay, so you were going to tell another story. Please do.
Yes, a very sweet story. So here was this little 4-year-old kid, and she has a 6-year-old brother. And mom tells the 6-year-old brother that he's 6 now, and it's his responsibility to set the table every night before dinner. Well, you know how little kids always want to be grown-ups. The little 4-year-old is very hopeful and kind of almost teary, and she says, well, what am I big enough to do now, Mommy? What can I do? Because I'm big, too. And so mom is thinking, what on earth am I going to give a 4-year-old to do? Because she doesn't want to break her heart and say you're not old enough to do anything. So she has this idea. Every morning they have a struggle for what the kid is going to wear to school. I can relate very well to that struggle, right? Because our granddaughter gives her mother the same kind of struggle every morning. Right. At that age, they are notorious for picking out the weirdest outfits. You know, in the middle of winter, they want to wear the bathing suit with a tutu, things that don't make any sense. So mother says to her, now that you're 4 years old and you're old enough to make proper choices, your job is you are responsible for choosing your clothes for the next day. Every night before you take a bath, you get your clothes out of your drawer, you put them on the bed ready to wear in the morning when you wake up. And so here was the household running around, the 6-year-old setting the table, and this little 4-year-old runs to her room and picks out her clothes for the next morning. And she's very proud. Look, Mommy, I did it. Come see, come see. And she had clothes laid out. Well, the next morning, instead of the usual having to coax her, and the kid is grumpy, and it's hard to get her dressed, and Mommy's choosing clothes, and she's not liking the clothes, the kid gets up and is in her clothes before she does anything else because she was so proud. So Mommy had given her something to live up to, a fine reputation that you're old enough to make good choices and pick out your clothes, and she lived up to it.
But as you point out, kids tend to pick out absurd. What if it's February in Washington, D.C., and she's picked out a bathing suit? I mean, isn't that the problem in general, that, and tying this back to adults, adult managers, we all know it's good to empower people to make choices, but not every one of their workers makes good choices. How do you deal with that?
Well, remember, she said, you're old enough now to make good choices. So what you can now say to her is, now that you're 4, you are very smart, and you know that it's cold because it's February, and so wearing a bathing suit is not a good choice for what you're going to wear today, instead of, no, you can't wear that bathing suit.
So we're back to, making things positive, making people feel good about themselves, couch everything in as positive and high expectations terms as you can. I mean, is it, it's not wrong, it's absolutely right, but are we basically saying that same old thing again?
Well, that's what the book is all about.
Yeah.
It's different manifestations of how you can say the right thing to make people feel good about themselves so that, and tap into what's important to them, their core desires, so that you get the outcome that you're looking for.
Let me give out the phone number one more time. If you would like the chance to ask Barbara or me a question, especially related to what we're talking about, which is the notion of And the topic is, the book is called How to Win Friends and Influence People in a Digital Age. So whether it's a digital relationship or an in-person relationship, if you have a challenging situation in which you need to win a friend and or influence a person and would like Barbara and my and or my ideas about how to deal with that, or you want to tell your story about how you followed or did not follow some of the principles we've talked about, here is the phone number at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Another of the book's chapters is something called Never Say You're Wrong. What do the authors mean by that?
Oh, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I was going to say, let's talk about Never Say You're Wrong.
Okay.
It is absolutely exactly what it says. When people disagree, underneath it all, there are generally some points on which they could agree. But what happens is party one says to party two, you're wrong about that. Mm-hmm. What happens if you're the person that is said
to? Oh, you get totally defensive and you're going to harden your position.
Absolutely right. So what he says is, what they say is, you never want to make people get defensive and respond emotionally. So what you want to say is, well, I might be wrong, but blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Or let's see if we can sit down and see if there's any place in which we might agree, because I suspect, with a smile, there probably are a lot of areas in which we would agree. And then let's see if we can find common ground to solve the problem.
Yep.
And as I read this, it brought me back to the lawsuit that the St. Helena School District filed against the County Office of Education. Instead of anybody saying, here's a problem, let's see if we can solve it together, what happened was I was told by the school district, you owe us money. You must give us this money. And when told that I was wrong, of course, what is my reaction? To defend, to say, no, that's not true. So, yes, I may think that I tried to say to them many times, folks, if we sit down together, I think there's a way to do this. We were already down the road of being adversaries. So if we can remember to avoid putting anybody into that situation in the first place, we're a lot more likely to be able to resolve our conflicts.
True enough. It's, you know, I'm always, you know, I guess, you know, when you have read so many of these how-to books and the advice comes down to very similar things, you know, how many times it's been said, you know, you want to say, you know, I can understand your point, but I'm wondering whether it might be a good idea to perceive it this way. You know, it feels like these are useful reminders, but you wonder in the world of how-to, how much really is new that is not situation specific. That's why I like so much going to the phones and asking people who need a 3-minute career makeover, because their individual circumstance calls for something unique. Let's we don't have callers on the line, so we've only got a few minutes left, so I'd rather talk with you, my love. By the way, my love, of course, is Dr. Barbara Nemko, Napa County Superintendent of Schools, and my frequent co-conspirator here on Work with Marty Nemko. The book, How to Win Friends and Influence People in a Digital Age, speaks of the importance of compassion. Instead of kind of reverting to some of this nice talk, I got to be honest. I have seen some very successful people use compassion as a ploy. They will feign compassion, but really, they're doing it just to get what they want. They're really quite ruthless. They try to get people on their side by saying, oh, yeah, I really understand how difficult that must be for you. I can really empathize. But really, they're quite ruthless beneath their kind words, and they will treat their employees as badly as possible and downsize them. Have you seen that?
To be perfectly honest, I have not. But I work in the world of education. And ruthlessness is not a core quality. If people go into education, not because they're ruthless, they go into education because they are generally very compassionate people who want to help kids. So no, and being ruthless in education isn't going to get you an extra dime anyway.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that that's the case. As you know, for a number of years, I was in the rose industry. I was a rose breeder, and I got a chance to work with people who were in, you know, seemingly the most romantic industry in the world. Roses, what could be? And they were absolutely ruthless. They were absolutely, you know, remember the story where, won't mention his name, but one of my fellow rose breeders had this brand new rose, a thornless rose that was wonderful. And they had thousands of the roses growing in a field. He hired somebody to grow, a farmer to grow thousands. And this is a farmer, you know, who could be nicer? A farmer who grows roses and had thousands of, you know, he paid to have thousands of roses grown. And then the farmer calls him one day and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, but there was a fire and all of your roses were lost, so you won't be able to get any of your royalties. I'm so sorry." And so this guy, I'll just say his first name is Harvey, drove down to Delano or wherever it was, somewhere down in the Central Valley. And yes, indeed, there was an area where the farmer showed him that was burned. And as he was leaving the farm, he was going the wrong way, and he was driving around, and he found a field like a half a mile away, and all of his roses were there. The farmer was going to steal his roses, not give him his royalty, and sell them. This is the nice farmer John in the rose industry. So, you know, and frankly, in the confidentiality of my office, where I've had 3,900 clients from, you know, I've had everybody from the unemployed person without an associate degree to corporate CEOs to physicians or whatever. In the confidentiality of my office, I've grown, I don't mean cynical, but a little, I view askance some of the nicey-nicey talk that goes on in front of the surface. Do you think I'm being too negative?
No, I think you make a really good point. And clearly, human beings are very complex. And obviously, all human beings are not good. That doesn't negate the fact that it is important to show compassion for people. The advice in this book is not brand new. It's not innovative. It's standard, what has become standard stuff, and yet this book has been immensely influential.
Even though it's the new book is in a digital age, but you're saying really the book is still the basic book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. We have just a few seconds left. So I want to give you, is there one more thing that you either want to reiterate or something new you haven't said about How to Win Friends and Influence People in a digital age that you haven't yet said?
We haven't talked about the fact that you can find connections so easily in this digital age.
Sure.
You can find anything that you want in two clicks of a mouse, that you have an opportunity to really expand whatever it is that you're trying to do, whether you're selling a product or just trying to influence people's thought in ways that you couldn't do before.
Yeah, but I do, and I'm going to add to that, I do think it is critical that you can't just invite people to be in your LinkedIn network. You must, you know, as they say, if you, both because it's cosmically right and because you expect something back, you've got to do things for other people before you expect to get anything back in return, even in the digital world. Anyway, Barbara Nemco, thank you very much for being my guest, I guess, on Work with Marty Nemco. And that is the show. I also want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers on callers. And Tucker Mays and Bob Sloan, they are the authors of Fired at 50. How to Overcome the Greatest Job Search Challenge. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.